Delighted to have you. Well, tonight, as you can see, it's going to be slightly different. We've got some interesting looking props here, and I think it's going to be a very exciting evening. We're delighted to have Lizzie Henson and Steph Brandt with us this evening from the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion. Both of them hold degrees in natural sciences from Cambridge. In fact, they worked through it together, so I think you said you've been together for 10 years. I take that to mean that you've known each other for 10 years. They're very much involved in the communication of public understanding of the interactions of science and faith, and very much involved in the school's work, so you'll find out about that tonight. In recent years, through hundreds of interactive sessions, books, and resources, they've guided many thousands of children and young people through discussions about science, faith, and their interaction in the modern world. And they're also active in developing a variety of teaching resources and offering training to teachers and church workers and others who are interested in communicating the Christian message in the terms of the relationship between science and faith. They're pretty exhausted, I think. They've done three schools in the last 2.5 days. So they really, we're working them hard whilst they're there. But we're really looking forward to this evening. Thank you both very much for coming. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Oh, great. I love having a round of applause before we've even started. It's a great confidence boost. So my name's Lizzie. Steph and I will tag team a little bit through this evening. And we do answer interchangeably to each other's names. So if you get confused at any point, just pick a name and go with it. As Andrew kindly introduced us, we both are scientists by background and by training. We both are Christians. And so this is kind of home for us this evening in many ways. And we've both been involved in communicating with young people in a variety of ways for a number of years. We're now officially co-directors of the Youth and Schools Programme at the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion, which is far too long a job title for anybody. But essentially, we really, really enjoy helping children, young people, and those who work and interact with them to think about big questions to do with science and religious faith and the interactions that come up there. So this evening, we're going to tell you a little bit about what we do and how we do it, hopefully to equip and resource all of you to therefore equip the young people and the children that you have in your lives, whether you're teaching, whether you're working with children and young people in church contexts, whether you have children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, you know anybody sort of under the age of 18, you have an amazing opportunity to speak into their lives and to demonstrate something of the interactions between science and faith and to help them explore that further. So just to kind of get started in that, we want to help you begin to think about this from the perspective of those young people. So what I'd like you to do for the next few moments is to imagine yourself into the mind of a child or young person of your choosing, pick an age anywhere between about 3 and 18. And I'm going to put some statements up on the screen up here, and I'd like you to show me by way of a sort of show of hands whether you, as that child or young person, agree or disagree with these statements. So I'll just ask for show of hands for mostly agree or for mostly disagree, and we'll see kind of what the room is feeling. So find your way into the mind of a child or young person you know and see how you feel about these statements. The first one, science can or will be able to explain everything. Science can or will be able to explain everything. Who, as their child or young person, would mostly agree with that? Fair show of hands. Who would mostly disagree? Okay, and have we got anybody kind of right in the middle, unsure? That's an excellent place to be. How about this? Now that we have science, we don't need religion anymore. Now we have science, we don't need religion anymore. You can tell I'm used to doing this in a classroom, I have to repeat it. It's impossible not to. Who would mostly agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, your RS teachers are not watching. who would mostly disagree? And who's kind of in the middle? Interesting, thank you. Science and religion give different answers to the same questions. Science and religion give different answers to the same questions. Who would agree with that? And who'd mostly disagree? And who's in the middle? Thank you. What about this? Science can prove that God does or does not exist. So science can prove whether or not God exists. Whose inner child would mostly agree with that? And whose would disagree? And who's in the middle? All right, thank you. One more for you. Most scientists believe in God. Most scientists believe in God. Whose would mostly agree with that? Whose would mostly disagree? And who's in the middle? That's very interesting. This one, interestingly enough, whenever we do this with a group, so we often start our sessions with this kind of series of questions. Whenever we do this with a group of students, of young people, this is the question where they all just pile into the middle and they go, well, I don't know, I haven't met most scientists. Which is a very impressive logical position, really, considering on all the others, they've been very happy that their opinion is the absolute truth. But the reason that we do this and we start off sessions with this is partly to get people moving. We always get people standing up and we say, okay, this side of the room has become I completely agree with everything and this side of the room is I completely disagree with everything and I was kind to you this evening. So it's partly to do that. It's partly to give us an indication of what's going on in the room. That's very helpful when you're talking to a group about a topic like this, that you kind of know who you're talking to. But it also introduces something of the nuance of the conversation so that we don't end up stuck on this idea that there's one question to explore, that science and religion do go together or they don't. But that actually there's a lot more going on. There's much more to discuss and explore in this. And it really opens up that idea of more to discuss, to think about. So another way that we begin our sessions is by doing a little bit of science. So this evening, we're going to do a little bit of science here with you, if that's okay. Part of what we want to do this evening, as I say, is to equip you to be working with the children and young people that you know. So we want to be giving you a few kind of ideas about what we do and how we do what we do, as well as why we do it. And part of that comes with a few key things. So one of those was getting people moving quickly and early on. Another is winning them over to you fairly early on. And we find that a good way to do that is by starting with something exciting and sciencey. Another way to win people over is just to have mysterious things on a table that people can't really tell what they are. We spent an entire morning today with a group of year five sixes discussing science and religion and fossils and evolution and the soul and everything. It was marvelous. And the whole way through, they were completely mystified about what this thing was on the table. And we just had a bowl like this, covered up with an old towel. And all the way through the session, they're like, but what's in the bowl? What's in the bowl? And we had to promise to show them what was in the bowl by the end of it. And you'll have to wait and see what's in the bowl because we're not going to show you until later. But I am going to start with a little bit of science. And in order to do this, I'm going to echo some of what's been said already this evening. I need some cash. Does anybody have any cash on them? Ideally, £20 in a single note. Or higher. Have you got some? Anybody got a 20?
If you need it.
Oh, marvellous. Thank you very much. Now, do you trust me? Wow. Okay. All right. So this is an excellent start. So again, if it helps with you enjoying this, transport yourself into the mind of your inner child. And who can tell me anything about this £20 note? This is audience participation time. It's got a metal strip. Okay. There's all sorts of fancy stuff going on in it. What else can you tell me about it? It's not vegan. Okay, yeah, we could go down that route. What else can you tell me? Oh, also, I'm sorry, I'm going to need hands up. I can't hear you all at once. Yes?
Materials it's made of are not the same value as what it represents.
Oh, we're going deep already here. Okay, let's stay slightly shallower for now. What's it made of, mostly? Plastic. This one's still paper, actually, for the most part. This is partly why we need 20 or above, because everything else has gone plastic, and you'll tell in a moment, or some of you might already have clocked what's going to happen. It just doesn't work quite as well with the plastic. So it's made of paper. Who can tell me anything about paper? What do we know about it? Yeah. It burns. That is a very interesting idea to bring up. So The purpose, really, of doing this science is partly to get people on side and to keep them excited and to demonstrate something of how science can be exciting and creative and fun. But it's also to help think through what science is and how it works. We spend a lot of our time, as I'm sure many of you have done in your reading and your thinking and presenting here, thinking through kind of the philosophy of science, essentially what science is and how it works. And this is something there are a lot of misconceptions about in amongst our young people, in our school system, and in our society in general, some of which came up a little bit in those statements, and some of which we will unpack further throughout this evening. But one of those misconceptions is just about kind of how science works. So we like to work our way through the method a little bit. We start with a question, like, for example, what will happen if I set fire to this piece of paper? We then bring in our background research, and we've done some of that already. We figured out, well, the piece of paper is probably going to burn, and we know some stuff about it. We've brought in our background research. We come up with a hypothesis. We do our experiment. We work them through this process. And part of doing that is to explore the fact that doing experiments is key to science, and therefore that science really only can explore questions which you can experiment and test and analyze in a certain way. And getting hold of that is quite key then to exploring how science interacts with other ways of thinking. Now, you all know this, so we don't really need to do the experiment, do we? One of the other things that we explore with science is how there's a common misconception, again, that science is about proving stuff, that it's about proving things to be absolutely true. We'll often hear from young people, science is about fact and religion's about faith, and those are very different things. So science is about proving stuff. So we spend a lot of our time actually explaining that science isn't really about proving stuff at all, which makes everybody a bit nervous, especially the science teachers. But exploring the idea of gathering together evidence and at some point saying, do you know, I think I've got enough evidence to choose to believe that that's a pretty good explanation of how this thing works. And we do it again and again and again and again, and we repeat and we get someone else to repeat and we all check each other's work. We never really say we've proven anything. But once we've gathered enough ideas together, and once we've got enough evidence, and once we've got a pretty good idea of how something works, we then can build on it. And this is where it gets really exciting, and how we can build our knowledge and find out more and more about the world. So we are fairly sure that if I set fire to this £20 note, it would burn. Yeah? And that, for many reasons, especially for our friend down the front here, might not be a brilliant idea. But we could perhaps make it a little bit more interesting. Can anybody, for example, think of anything off the top of their head that doesn't burn? I mean, that's a fantastic idea. I have no idea where that came from. So here's a thought, new question. What happens if you take something that we know burns, something that we know doesn't burn, mix them together, and set fire to it? New question, bring in some background knowledge, and we do the experiment. Does anybody have a hypothesis? What might happen? You're getting very nervous about the smoke detector. I mean, there's one way to find out, right? Okay, so immediately, some smart aleck down the front has made a further step in our scientific process. We did our experiment, we observed something that happened, we analyze our results, and we assess whether or not our hypothesis was correct. And if it wasn't correct, because what we were really expecting was that this would be too damp to burn, right? So we go back and we look at what was happening. We figure we've missed something somewhere. Our picture of what was going on wasn't complete. And perhaps one step we could examine is whether or not this suspicious-looking bottle of clearish liquid that I cunningly introduced to that experiment is not, in fact, water. Now, again, if you were a group of primary students in particular, I would get you to think about what it might be and make some observations using your noses to figure out whether this smelt of anything in particular. Answers range from, it smells like those pens that we use sometimes, it smells like nail varnish remover, it smells like my dad when he comes home late on a Friday. Anybody have any informed guesses about what this might be. Meth's a good shout. Alcohol, yeah, it's actually... oh, so many guesses. It's a 50-50 mix of isopropyl alcohol and water. So essentially what we get, the alcohol gives us that lovely flame, it burns off nice and quickly, the water keeps the paper damp enough that it doesn't burn up. So the paper is fine, we can say thank you very much and return that to its owner. So a round of applause for the trust there. So by doing that, I get a little magic moment of looking like a magician. Everybody is now very interested in what's happening, and I've won you all over because I set fire to something, and that's an instant win. But we've also had a chance to explore what science is, how it works. We've learned something about it. We've learned something about the creativity and the excitement of it, but also about its limits, about the kinds of questions it's very good at exploring. How big is that? How old is that? How far away is that? What will happen if I set fire to that? And we start to lay the groundwork for exploring some of the questions that it might not be so good at exploring, and what we do with those, and how they might sit alongside our questions of science. And we will explore and unpack a little bit more of how we do that, but before we do that, I'm going to hand over to Steph to walk us through a little bit of the kind of world of science and faith for children and young people.
Fab, thanks, great. My mic's on, that's good news. Okay, so if we just think back a bit to what we were looking at, those statements that we were thinking, do our young people agree with that, disagree with that, or are they unsure about it? And think a little bit about what they might think the state of the relationship between science and faith might be. A lot of young people around, we might think, kind of perceives the relationship between science and faith to be in conflict in some way. That there's really religion versus science, it might be faith versus facts and hard evidence. That faith at its best is this kind of fluffy, just believe whatever you want, or at its worst could be downright dangerous. And that is certainly one impression that is out there that the media really loves to play upon because, well, a conflict is exciting and it sells newspapers. So that is one idea that's out there. But we all know that there's a lot of other stuff going on, that there's certainly much more to the discussion than that. There are so many scientists, like Francis Collins up there, who are writing amazing books on science and faith, theologians thinking about science and faith. There's a real positive dialogue that's ongoing about science and faith and how they might fit together and their positive interactions. So there's one view out there that they're in conflict, and there are some other views out there that maybe it's not quite that simple. Maybe there's an interesting discussion to be had. But what is it that young people actually think? What ideas are they coming into contact with? Well, there are plenty of people who have done research on this, particularly Barry Billingsley and Keith Tabor have produced some very helpful papers that have really dug into kind of what's going on and what young people are thinking. And don't worry, I'm not going to make you read all of these, but the bottom line is kind of summarized nicely by this pie chart. So this was a research project that I kind of helped with. I was going into schools and I was handing out just a little survey at the start of the day and the same survey at the end of a day of exploring science and faith. And young people were asked to select whether they strongly agree, don't really know, all the way through to strongly disagree on a series of statements. And I've just picked one to kind of share what was going on. And this is from a good number of 15 to 18-year-olds in Church of England schools. And we asked them, how much do you agree with the idea that the scientific view is that God does not exist? And the big blue nearly half there is agree with that statement. So a huge number of young people at Church of England secondary schools are encountering this idea, or at least in some way have come up with this idea that science has a view about whether God does or does not exist. Now, there's also plenty of people who are uncertain and plenty of people who disagree. But it's interesting and a little concerning. And to dig a little bit deeper into this, these research papers actually talked to the kids as well. The researchers wanted to hear in full sentences rather than just tick boxes exactly what young people thought. And so here are just a few of the comments that came out. Science and religion are at war. They disagree, and it is making me feel uncomfortable with my religion. I want to believe in God, but science is making new answers. I don't know what to believe. I grew up as a Christian, but science is changing all of it now. And it seems like there's this quite common view that science or faith, I have to choose, and it seems like science is the future. It's the new way forward. It's the thing that will replace faith. And there's uncertainty and confusion out there about what to believe and what to trust. So we know that this is a kind of sensationalized media view out there. But like we saw on one of the previous slides, there's lots of amazing literature. There's lots of groups like Christians in Science. There's all sorts of wonderful stuff going on to encourage people to think about the positive interactions between science and faith. So why do young people still think that there's a conflict? Now, one of those reasons is actually the majority of conferences out there aimed at people over the age of 18, shall we say. And so they aren't getting the opportunity to access these ideas for themselves. And one of the other issues is that, particularly after primary school, they have a timetable in their school. They might have 4+ lessons of science in a week, and they might only have one lesson of RE, and their RE lesson is unlikely to be with their science teacher, and their science lesson is unlikely to be with any relation to their religious studies teacher or the course that they're studying in religious studies. And suddenly everything is in neat little boxes in different parts of the school, and they've lost any opportunity for asking, well, how might this subject fit with this subject? Now, that all seems pretty doom and gloom and pretty serious and quite negative for this time on a Friday night. But the good news is that they might think that there's a conflict, but they also still have questions, and they also still want to ask those questions and find a space somewhere between science and religious studies where they can voice those questions. So Lizzie and I work with about 3 to 18-year-olds most of the time, hopefully not all on the same day. That would be quite a lot to take in. But these kinds of questions can come out of the mouth of an 18-year-old, or they can come out of the mouth of a 4-year-old. Once you've given them some of the language to voice their questions and the permission and a space to do that, where you'll listen and you'll respect their question and not say, oh, that's a silly question, don't ask that, or oh, that's a bit rude, please be quiet, don't rock the boat. They want to ask the questions, and they will. So what was before the Big Bang? Does evolution take away the need for God? Where do Adam and Eve fit in? Does science allow for miracles or a soul? If there were a multiverse, how would that affect your faith? What's the meaning of life? Nice, simple one there to tackle. If God is so loving, why is there so much suffering? Now, that bottom one, that will come up in every school that we go into, pretty much regardless of the topic we're talking about. And it's an amazing opportunity to have a chance to just share a little bit of our thinking on it. So young people are they've picked up on this idea that there's a conflict. The wonderful work that's being done by lots of people to say that there isn't a conflict isn't really filtering down to them yet. But they have questions. Well, does it really matter that they have these questions and no one is necessarily helping them to explore it? I personally think that it really does matter. So at the moment, a lot of the young people that I talk to are hearing you have to choose. You can't be a scientist and a person of faith. And if you have to choose, then that's a real shame. Because essentially, you're either saying, well, I won't do science, or I'll walk away from my faith in God. And Lizzie and I, in our own experience, have had to explore those things for ourselves. And what we tend to share when we're in schools is a bit of our story about how we've come for ourselves through from hearing, no, you have to choose, to a place where we're like, no, you don't have to choose. And holding both of them together is so exciting. So we'll share that with young people. And I think that the reason that's so important isn't just, oh, well, it's nice to hold science and faith together, but it's also that a lot of our big questions that we have about who we are, our place and our purpose in the universe, things like what to do and what to think about artificial intelligence or how to respond to the climate crisis, all of those questions are questions that need science, but they also need other voices too, voices from theology and faith and philosophy and history and all these wonderful areas of human knowledge. And if we only pay attention to one of them, and if we only give children the permission to explore one of these areas, then we're not helping to support or equip them for a future that is full of huge questions. So the good news is that there are plenty of groups now. And we've seen a real increase in this over the last few years as well, which is wonderful. An increase in the number of groups that are creating some space for young people to explore science and faith for themselves. So there's us at the Faraday Institute, and I'll be inviting Lizzie back up in just a second to talk a little bit about what we do and what we've learned along the way. There's also the God and the Big Bang Project, based out of Manchester Diocese. Messy Church Does Science is an absolutely wonderful resource that's well worth checking out if you haven't. The Epistemic Insight Group is actually the LASAR project, so the Learning About Science and Religion project, which is down at Canterbury Christ Church University. And that's led by Barry Billingsley, who is the person who's been doing all this research that I talked about earlier. Her focus is particularly on supporting teachers and training of new teachers and exploring how we can better support teachers in particular to allow for this sort of cross-curricular exploration within school education. So there's lots of great stuff going on. And just to give an example, I'll get Lizzie back up to talk about what we do at Faraday.
Thank you.
I feel a bit jealous because I just shared all the miserable stuff and Lizzie gets to come and talk about the fun
We've
stuff.
We've swapped. Normally it's me that does all the doom and gloom and Steph gets to come and do the kind of brightening things up again. But this time it's my turn to do that. So we are the Faraday Institute. We work a lot in schools. We have always done a little bit of work in schools. Steph mentioned Barry Billingsley and her work now down in Canterbury Christ Church. She began her work at the Faraday Institute. And was doing a lot of her research out of that. And that involved a bit of work in schools. And most organisations that have anything to do with science and religion, whether it's the Faraday Institute, the Ian Ramsey Centre in Oxford, various Christians and science groups, or even people who make a bit of a name for themselves as somebody who will happily talk about this, will be sort of beset by invitations, usually from sixth form colleges, saying, oh, we need to do a thing about science and religion. Could you come and talk to us? So that sort of thing's been going on for quite a while, and I imagine that a number of you also receive those invitations and do that kind of thing from time to time. Around about 6 or so years ago, I was finishing up studying sciences in Cambridge and trying to figure out what to do with my life, and figured I was spending so much of my time already talking about science and faith that maybe I could do something with that. And I was in touch with these people at the Faraday Institute, and I was trying to kind of figure out what God wanted me to do between that side of things and all this stuff I'd been doing with children and young people. And they both seemed really important. And looking back, I don't know what took me quite so long to figure it all out. But I was trying to choose between these things, essentially, in my head. And at some point, had this kind of brainwave with God helping me along a lot that was, well, why don't you just mix those two together? Because the problem that we have with the whole science faith thing is that it isn't happening for young people. This was a great thing to discover, but there weren't any jobs doing that, which was slightly awkward. But what I did was got in touch with the people at the Faraday Institute, where I was already in Cambridge, and had a bit of a chat with some of them there, including Dennis Alexander, who some of you may know. And they essentially just sort of invented a job, which I came into and began building this app. And since then, we've seen that grow. I became incredibly busy and managed to get a grant to bring Steph in alongside me. We've now built that up further. We're hoping to bring some more people into the team. But we, since that time, have done a lot of stuff in schools with people of all different ages and stages. The reason that we work particularly in schools, we do work with young people in churches and other situations as well, but schools are an amazing opportunity for this because young people are already there. And not only are they already there, they're kind of trapped there. They have to be there. And they're prepared to learn. There's a wonderful thing about coming into a classroom with young people who sometimes they're a little reluctant to learn, particularly the older they get, but there's still something in there that's expecting to take in new information and consider it. And that happens much, much more with young people than it does with anybody who's left the school system. Once we leave the school system, this thing takes place in our minds where we sort of think, oh gosh, now I feel like I need to work like a functioning adult. I just assume that I know stuff now. And we stop being quite so ready to learn unless we force ourselves to do it. But in school, they're prepared to learn, to think, to take in new ideas, to explore new ideas. And if you present new ideas to them in a way that they are interested to kind of consider them, then wonderful and marvelous things take place. So that is what we have the privilege of doing, of traveling around the country, going to all kinds of different schools, talking about all kinds of different things to help them explore this. We've done over 800 sessions in the last 5 or so years, seen over 22,000 students so far. Obviously, the numbers update fairly regularly. I have lost track of how many we've seen this week, but we should add them to it as well. As Steph said, and the ages range between sort of 3 and 18. We do occasionally talk to grown-ups as well when they let us out, but generally, this is a rarity. We talk about all sorts of different things. And one of the things that's exciting in this is that we can bring to it our particular passions and expertise in terms of the areas that we've studied, but there are all sorts of other big topics that come up that we maybe haven't got a degree in, but we've got enough of an insight and we're surrounded by people and good information that can help us explore those topics and think about whatever questions it may be that the young people have, enough to help them think about it a little bit more. We don't have to be the world expert in it. We just have to kind of approach it with a humility that says, this is a really interesting topic. I've thought about it a little bit. I can help you think about it and then go on to explore some more. So we're able to do that, and we get some wonderful feedback from students. One of my favorite bits of feedback we got was, I don't know if it's up there, actually. Did we put it up there? No, we're not. It was one that just said, this was the best day ever. It was so exciting, I thought my head was going to explode. which I think if you can get that level of feedback, we've done something either really, really well or really, really wrong. As far as I know, their head didn't explode. But it just demonstrates, this isn't to blow our own trumpets at all, this is to demonstrate how excited young people are to consider these topics. They're really, really up for it. And actually, these topics in particular, but anything that gives them an opportunity to explore questions between those boxes, questions that cross the subject boundaries. One of the things that we see from our research is that students learn very early, as they go through primary school even, that they should not ask questions like this of anybody. So it's not just that they learn something about it or that they take in this idea that science and faith are in conflict, but they learn to stop asking the questions because people don't want to answer them. Whether that's science teachers, RE teachers, parents, pastors, children's workers, whoever it may be, this sort of slight level of awkwardness that this is controversial and I don't want to mislead you, and sidestepping the question that a lot of very well-meaning people do actually can sometimes communicate you shouldn't have asked that question. So one of our favorite things to encourage people to do is just to say something like, that's a really brilliant question. Isn't that an exciting question? Do you know I don't really know the answer, but maybe we could find out. And just by doing that, you validate that question and you set them off on a whole different trajectory. So we have a lot of fun with students. As I mentioned, we talk about lots and lots of different topics. And one of the things we would really like to encourage you this evening is you may be an expert in some area. There may be something that you could genuinely talk to them about for days and days and days and days. There may be some other things that you're not an expert in. But you can go to a reputable source online or some papers or something. You can look it up. You can learn enough of what the current situation is. You can read up in some of these incredible books and academic studies that are being done all the time. And then know enough to translate that to the point that you can get some young people interested in it too. Most of what is impactful to the young people we work with is seeing somebody who's passionate about something. That's what impacts them. Ideally, passionate about something that they're also communicating reliably and not just kind of spouting, oh, I read this thing on Facebook earlier, posted from I don't really know where, but it might be true. But actually, it's not that difficult to read up on something enough from reputable sources to be able to be passionate about it and explore it with young people and explore their questions. And the thing that we really hope for when we speak to young people anywhere is that rather than them taking in all the details that we taught them about evolution or stem cells or whatever it might be, that they remember, I once met somebody who was really into science and really engaged with their personal faith, and they held those two things together, and we had a good time. And if they remember that, then if any questions ever come up for them about can science and religion go together, is it possible to be a serious scientist and hold a faith? They've immediately got something in their head that says, yeah, that is possible. And that's really not difficult for any of us to do. Another positive in this is that we get good feedback from the staff as well. It's not just children with their heads exploding everywhere. But staff are really keen for this. The majority of teachers, and there may be some in the room, are exceptionally busy, but really, really keen to help the children that they're teaching engage with the topics, explore their questions, and become the young people that they're becoming, that they're meant to be, that they're made to be. And if we can help with that a little bit, many teachers will bite your hand off for coming in and doing something that helps them engage with their topics. Now, we drop in a lot of useful buzzwords. We connect deliberately with curriculum in various areas. We've done a lot recently looking at evolution for kind of year 5, 6 age groups because it's come into the syllabus fairly recently, and suddenly you have primary teachers who already have to teach every topic to their students, having to become experts in evolution. And many of them are teaching that in C of E schools, where they're teaching creation and they're teaching evolution, and suddenly they're met with all these questions. So we're not only doing that with the young people, but also delivering some teacher training to help them explore it. And the response from teachers is really very positive. So to think through a little bit of what we do and how we do it, I've covered some of this already, but essentially we cover a whole range of different topics. Anything that we can be remotely interesting and passionate about for enough time to help them put some questions together. And it's not just us that does this. We help to train up other people who are experts and interested in particular areas of science and have a faith to talk about their area of science. Generally, we start with the science. We start by demonstrating that we have some credibility in that area. And one of the reasons for that is that for the majority of young people today, they respect science very highly. So if we can prove to them, in some sense, that we're genuine scientists, that we're taking the science seriously, they then start to listen to us when we talk about some of the other stuff as well. In some situations, we flip it around. In particular church contexts, we'll go in and demonstrate that we're real, genuine Christians, first off, and then they can start to listen to us when we talk about the other things. So again, just being aware of your audience, thinking about who they are and what they may have heard, and all of that is always done very gently. We're never trying to tell anybody they're wrong. We're never trying to upset the worldview that anybody has, and particularly with children. Their parents are obviously a very strong influence, particularly when they're younger. And we don't want to send them home going, some teacher came in and told me that everything you've ever taught me is a lie. It's just not going to be a very productive thing. But if we can help them to open their minds up and explore and get excited about exploring, and to recognize that actually they can do that, that it's not going to be damaging to science, it's not going to be damaging to faith to explore these things. So we begin with some science, and we look at a number of different things in this. And we thought at this moment that you have been sitting for a little while, it might be worth doing a little bit more science. Again, to think through how we can use this, how we can do it well, and to reward you for all your wondering about what's in the bowl. Are you ready for this? I mean, we could here go into a deep philosophical discussion about whether there is nothing in the bowl, whether there is air in the bowl, what nothing even is. I'm not going to do any of that. I just haven't put anything into it yet. I am going to put something into it, and that something is water. This really is water this time. You can decide for yourselves whether that's proof enough. Going to pop some water into this bowl. And I want to do this again to explore a little bit about how science works. So we use science to explore the world around us, the universe around us, to explore some of the properties of the things around us, and to build up our knowledge as we go. Now, if I were with a group of students at this point, I would ask for some volunteers. Do I have two volunteers in the house tonight, or are we all too grown up for that? I could do with two. Tina, I knew you'd have your hand up. So anybody else willing to come and join Tina up at the front here? Yeah, absolutely. Well done. Let's have a round of applause for our volunteers. Thank you very much. Now, would you two like to pick a straw each? Don't worry, this also isn't a psychological test based on the colour of straw that you chose. We're going to explore this water a little bit. We're going to think about it, some of the things that we know about it, some of the things we can learn about it. And I would love it if you two could figure out a way to get some air into this water for me. Do you think you could do that? Beautifully done. Let's have another go. Excellent work. Thank you very much. You can just stay here a moment. So can any of you watching tell me what was happening there? What do we know? What background research, what ideas that we've learned from science can we bring in to understand what was happening?
It wasn't there, of course. It was exhaled breath.
Excellent point. So we've got exhaled breath made up of a variety of gases, hopefully all healthy ones, going into this water. So it's coming from your lungs, as you point out. So you've got air in your lungs of some kind. You push it out through the straw into the water. And then what happened? Oh, I wish it was that clever. It's not. It's really just water. I know I've got you all really suspicious now.
Can I put air in a different way?
If it's safe and sanitary.
I've squeezed that shut.
Ooh.
Look at that. Beautifully done. All right, so a variety of methods. That's never happened before. Variety of methods of getting air into my water. Who can tell me what was happening once it got into the water? What happened? It's simpler than you think it is, I promise. Yeah. It tried to get out. And how did it try to get out? Which way did it go? Upwards. Excellent. It rejoined the air. We could talk about displacement. We could talk about densities. We were doing this in a school. It was yesterday. And one of the kids answered with a thing and said, and because the air is lighter than the water. Wait, less dense than the water. And his science teachers were sitting at the back and had just a beautiful moment of, oh, we taught him something. So we had little pockets of air under the water for a short time, or we could call them bubbles. We had our bubbles for a little bit, and they hung around a bit, and as they came up, they stretched the surface of the water just a little, and then they popped. So to do this, we think about surface tension. We can think about the properties of water that give us surface tension. We'll often ask if anybody knows the scientific name we use for water. Does anybody know? H2O, very good. I'll stop patronizing you quite so much now. So we talk about the properties of water, the surface tension, a little bit about that. And then we realize, okay, so we think we're pretty sure how this works. We've got a fairly good understanding of this. So now we can add something else in. And for me, I want to see whether we can get those bubbles to stick around a bit longer. So we add in something else. This is Ecova washing up liquid. Other brands are available. Now I'm going to ask you two to do the same thing. Importantly, please blow, don't suck. I will not be held responsible. Very impressive. Do you want to add a few more for me? Marvellous, thank you. Hang out here for just a second longer. Okay, so we've got our bowl here. We did exactly the same thing, but we changed one thing. And what's different this time? What have we observed that's different? Bubbles, exactly right. So the bubbles stick around a little bit longer. And again, we can explore things about surface tension and all the other stuff that's going on here when we add in this soap. And we eventually get to the point of going, okay, so we think we're pretty sure what's going on here now. We're fairly sure we know how this works. So maybe we could add something else into the picture. Now you'll notice that I'm just getting my hair out of the way briefly, adding a few other bits to the ensemble. This is, as all good scientists wear a lab coat at least some point in the evening. I'm not even a chemist. It's just for show. We could ask another question, like, what happens if I set fire to it? We like that question, remember? So we could see what happens. Would you humor me and give me a 3, 2, 1? Purely to build tension, because you all knew that nothing was going to happen. Because you are, of course, a few steps ahead of the average primary school student who just gets very excited that I'm going to set fire to something, cares not one whit that I'm about to set fire to my hand. But you, of course, have all figured out that the only things in this bowl are water, which isn't particularly flammable, soap, which isn't generally flammable unless I've done something very weird to it, although you would have license to mistrust me after the earlier experiment, and the breath of our dear colleagues here, who is very unlikely to be flammable. So one of the things, interestingly, that we recognise from this is that science can often be disappointing, which is a bit of a sad thing to learn, but perhaps necessary if one is considering a career in the sciences, that sometimes what we expect or what we hypothesise even doesn't happen quite how we thought it might. You can take a seat. Thank you for your help. You. Let's have a round of applause. But as you can imagine, to leave that there would be slightly disappointing. And we could consider perhaps changing it up a little bit more, adding something else into the picture. For example, if I were to fill my bubbles with something slightly different, for anybody who can't see, this is labeled science gas, because I'm not allowed to tell anybody what it is. Doesn't take a genius to work it out. If I were to fill my bubbles with something slightly different, and just change one thing, but keep everything else the same, and ask you once more to humor me, and give me a 3, 2, 1. The results might be slightly different. Now again, you've all woken up, I set fire to something again, but we get another chance to explore how science works, something of what it is really good at exploring, the questions it is really good at thinking about. And once we've done that, and again, we've established ourselves as credible scientists, if only by putting on a lab coat briefly, we then are in a place where we can consider, okay, so science is really good at answering some things. Is there anything else that it's not so good at exploring? At this point, we'll use different ideas to explore this. We'll often use the famous kettle example that many of you will know. If you came into a room and there's a kettle boiling away and I asked you, why is that kettle boiling? You might tell me any number of things. For example, anybody? It's coffee time, okay? And we could get any number of answers through for this. Depending on the age of the students, you'll get anything between the water's getting hot and, oh, wait, I just prepped this for my A-level. Let me tell you everything I know about excitement in water and all that kind of thing. But we essentially get to the point where we've got a scientific answer and we've got the idea that someone wants a tea or coffee. And then you get to explore, well, which of those is right? And of course, they're both right. And everybody's very happy with this idea that you can have two completely different answers to the same question that are simultaneously right. So we explore that a little bit and unpack that the science is really exploring kind of how the kettle is boiling. We prefer to say the mechanism of what's going on, the kind of nitty-gritty. But me wanting a cup of tea doesn't explore the same thing. That explores a slightly different aspect, if you like, the purpose of what's going on. For some people, wanting a cup of tea is the entire purpose and meaning of their existence, let alone the kettle boiling. But we essentially unpack something along the lines of, the kettle could be boiling because I want a cup of tea, And what's happening is that the water's being heated to 100 degrees and we get a state change. And it's not only that those two different answers are both valid, but that when we combine them together, we get a bigger picture of what's going on and a better picture, a fuller picture of what's going on. So from that kind of simple example, we can then extrapolate out. We do this sometimes with a whole kind of murder mystery setup. We use Cluedo as a way to get them to bring in different types of evidence and recognize they need all kinds of different types of evidence to work together, the scientific and the testimonial evidence and all sorts of different things working together to help them understand and explore these big questions. This jigsaw in the middle is one of our ways of demonstrating that these different types of thinking and questioning don't sit on their own, that they actually interact with each other. That you don't do science for very long before you run into questions about, well, what should I do with what I can do? And then when you're thinking about, well, what should I do, somebody might bring in ideas from history or from their religious faith. And that actually these things are very intertwined. And one of the things we work quite hard to explore is the idea that some of these other ways of thinking can be equally valid to science. That's one of the kind of struggles in thinking, is that science is more valid as a way of thinking, that it's just better as a way of knowing than anything else. And some of the ways to explore that are with pictures like this along the bottom, to say, well, we ask them what this is on the left over here, and say, well, it's a sunset, and what do you think of it? Somebody will say, it's beautiful. And we say, okay, well, how could we explore that with science? Because science can tell us some things about the sunset, can tell us about the light and the reflection, the refraction, but it doesn't tell us whether or not it's beautiful. Similarly, we look at topics like the climate crisis that young people are very aware of at the moment. The science has been well known for a very long time. So why isn't more happening? What other questions are in there that are relevant, necessary to explore? Or if you want to know whether somebody loves you, you obviously get a blood test and send that off and it comes back and then you know whether they love you or not. I'm always looking out for the one person just going, well, yeah. I won't tell you who it was. And with very simple examples like this, you can begin to unpack the fact that it's not only us saying that we should ask different types of questions, but just recognizing that actually we all do. We spend our whole lives every day considering lots of different types of evidence, drawing it together, and at some point saying, I think I've got enough evidence to choose to believe that this is the way this thing works. It's exactly the same thing that we do with questions about God, whether there is a God, who that God might be, whether that God might want anything to do with me, whether I might want anything to do with that God. So depending on the situation we're in and what we're asked to cover by the school or wherever else we might be, we explore some different aspects of what that looks like. We'll very often use examples of scientists of faith from history or from today. And again, that's a really, really key way to do this, to think through that this isn't just about me telling my story or me trying to tell somebody what to think, but demonstrating that there are and have been people throughout history who hold these two things together. Now, some of this is very useful for the kind of myth-busting activity that we spend a lot of time doing. We spent quite a time today with some Year 5, 6 students exploring the whole Galileo affair. Many of them informed us that Galileo had discovered that God wasn't real, and so the church arrested him, which is fairly commonly thought. So we explored and unpacked a little bit more of that, what had actually seemed to have gone on, and some of the poor decisions that were made on both parts, many of which have since been apologized for. But you're able to do, by doing that, able to demonstrate something of the slightly more complex, nuanced, more messy human history of science, of religious faith, and of the journey of those two things together. And also just able to demonstrate from a distance very easily, there are lots of people who hold these two things together who are at the forefront of science, doing it not only with, but because of their faith. We also will look at a number of these questions that Steph mentioned, talking about suffering, talking about various different bits and pieces of the science-religion discussion that you'll all be very familiar with. And sometimes going into particular detail on things like biblical interpretation, how we think about Genesis, how we think about where the Bible talks about creation, God as creator in a number of different places. There are all sorts of different topics and questions that come up. And like I said, we're not experts on all of them. We spend a lot of our time saying, I don't know. And that's actually a really powerful tool. It's very, very important, very powerful to be able to say, particularly to a young person, I don't know. But that's a really interesting question. Why don't we explore that? It's especially useful. Our younger generations today are so overwhelmed with information. From as soon as they can take anything in, they're taking in information from all over the place. Most of us, when we grew up, there were a limited number of places we got information from that we would take seriously. Nowadays, absolutely anybody can publish anything online very easily, and young people know that. So they're having to work out a whole new way of figuring out who to trust. It's not as simple as, well, I trust my parents and my teacher and the man on the BBC. It's much, much more complicated. They've got a much bigger problem in working out who to trust. And one of the ways that they take in information best is through story. Not people telling them, you must think this, but people saying, here's my story. Here's some of what I've thought and how I've thought about this, and that my thinking is developing and continuing. Now, what do you think? And as you do that, as you share humbly and gently, but in a considered way, they're then able to take bits of that on board, think it through, consider it, and go, yeah, well, that seemed to make sense. They seem to be a genuine person. I could explore that a bit more. Maybe I could think like that. And so this is a really, really key way of communicating at the moment. And it's a real privilege. It's a real privilege to do it. So I'm going to sit down again. I'm going to let Steph come and tell you a little bit more about what actually happens when we do this, how it goes down, what the impact of this work is.
Great. Cool. So, does any of this stuff that we're talking about actually do any good? The good news is, yes, it does. So, thinking back to that kind of research that I was telling you about, handing out a survey at the start of the day, and handing out the same survey again at the end of the day, that enabled us to take a look at how much young people had changed in their thinking over the course of a day, just exploring some of these ideas that Lizzie was just sharing about. These are, again, with the 15 to 18-year-olds I was talking about earlier. So this first statement here, I believe science and religion can fit together. Before, at the start of the day, there was a lot of uncertainty. 31% of people agreed. By the end of the day, that's 55%, which is really exciting. And for teenagers to admit willingly that they've changed their mind or changed their thinking on something is really wonderful. Very exciting. I'm going to take it as a real encouragement. This one here, quite similar. Science makes it hard to believe in God. I think it's a real shame that at the start of the day, so many young people were saying science does make it hard to believe in God. And I think it's wonderful that by the end of the day that had really changed. I think it's interesting that we've seen some uncertainty go up, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that uncertainty, if you can model what to do with your uncertainty, how to ask questions, where you might go to try and explore some of the potential answers to those questions, then that's great. I would far rather equip young people to think for themselves than to tell them what I think the answer is. Because if I've equipped them to think for themselves and to do that well and rigorously, then they're going to find out really useful and interesting things about these kinds of questions. And just one more from this particular study. Evolution is compatible with creation by God, which is a really, really interesting and quite nuanced statement in itself. And by the end of a day, we'd actually seen a lot of young people saying, yeah, this idea, this scientific idea of evolution, this particular process that's responsible for all this wonderful diversity that we can see in the world around us, That is completely compatible with the idea that there is a creator God behind all of it. And that's so exciting because essentially they've really taken hold of an idea that the more science I do and the more science I can find out about, the bigger God might get. Rather than this idea of God being pushed out or threatened by science, suddenly science is on the same side as the creator God. And that is just a wonderful thing for young people to tap into. Okay, so in words as well, here is feedback from some of the students. It's overwhelmingly positive. The two that I really want to draw out are the top two. The Q&A session was mind-blowing. Not quite head-exploding, but mind-blowing, you know, similar. And they answered questions that people are often afraid to go into that I ask about. I think I just want to encourage you in that. In your conversations that you have with young people, recognize that they're not looking, they're not wowed by the intellect. They're not wowed by a clever answer, but they really appreciate someone being willing to sit down and consider with them, to listen to a question of theirs and say, wow, that's an amazing question. I've never heard that before. So for example, we've had one that was, if I go and stand in the sea for long enough, will I become a mermaid? It's an amazing question. And it's funny, and you weren't expecting it. But it's so worth just, rather than being like, oh, don't be silly. You're not a mermaid. There's no such thing as a mermaid. Why don't you have a chance to sit down and think about it and maybe chat through evolution and how it works and how it definitely doesn't work and all of that. But really, they just want someone with a bit of honesty and integrity to go, that's a lovely question. Let's think about it. And even if you don't know the answer, being willing to say, you know, I'm not really sure, and here are some of my first thoughts on it. And maybe I'll go away and just read up a little bit on some of this, on some of the lovely websites that exist, like Christians in Science, that has a great thinking about series, for example. I think one thing that, the reason I think they value the Q&A time so much is that kind of humility and willingness to say, I'm not really sure. Young people are so tuned in to body language and emotions, and they really know if you're blagging. If you're pretending to know an answer, they know it. And so you might as well show them something a bit different. Show them security and humility as you explore a big topic with them. And I think another reason that it's so important to do that is that at the moment, everything on their exams is about, here's the question, here is the right answer, write down the right answer, you get the mark, and you pass the exam. And the real world isn't like that. It's full of big questions, and some of those questions, there might be an answer out there, but actually some of those questions, no one really knows the answer yet, and we might never know the answer. And so modeling what to do with that uncertainty and demonstrating that that's still exciting and it's still worth having those conversations and working out maybe what you think about it, even if it's not a right answer, like there isn't a right answer and there isn't a mark that you're going to get for talking about it, is so worthwhile. So don't be afraid to dive into some interesting and weird and big questions with young people because they absolutely love it. Okay, so moving forwards, we've been doing schools work for quite a long time now, as Lizzie was sharing, and we want to do more than that as well. And so we've essentially, as the Youth and Schools team at Faraday, come up with this bit of vision here, which is really that we want to change the nature of science faith communication to generations of children, young people, and teachers. Just a small thing, you know. Some of what that looks like is equipping young people with places to go where they might be able to explore some of their questions. So we have been working on a website for young people. We're also working on a website for teenagers, and we are working on one currently for educators and influencers as well. And we just really want to create a place where people can come to for answers, but also come to for recommendations of resources that are out there that might help you to make some of this accessible to your young people. So the websites, the kids one is out, the teens one and the educators ones are coming, so watch this space. And we've also, over the last few years, been working on a number of book and app resources, some of which are out, some of which are on the way. And they are there mostly because, for ages, people were coming up to us and saying, hey, what you do is great, I love it. What can I give an 8-year-old that has questions about dinosaurs and wants to explore it with God? And the answer has been, there's really not much that I can recommend. So we are trying to change that. We're trying to work with multiple different publishers to sort of shape a new way of communicating to young people about science and about God that supports both of those things. And so we've got the Wonder Zone up there, which is the Scripture Union Holiday Club this year. We've got a copy of it on the table over there for you to take a look at. We're so excited that Scripture Union was on board and keen to do something with us on that. There's the Curious Crime there in the middle, which is kind of this, it's this fiction, fantasy, historic adventure that gets at these ideas about, well, what kinds of questions does science answer? And what kinds of questions doesn't it answer? And do I need both of them? But it's just a really wonderful, gentle, fun adventure. I got to read it quite a lot of times before it got published, and I love it. So everyone else must too. The Book of Wonders is on its way. And these three down here are for 3 to 5-year-olds. They're God made space, God made the world, and God made animals. And they'll be out in March and April this year. And we're really, really excited about them. And all of these, they're very different styles. Some of them are for grown-ups to use with young people. Some of them are for sort of 12-year-olds. Some of them are for really little people as well. And we're also working on resources, a resource for teachers to use in their lessons so that when they're really, really busy but they want to do something that will be helpful for young people in this area, they don't have to do a huge amount of work to have something ready to go. So there's lots of things coming out, lots of things that are out, so watch this space, come and talk to us afterwards, keep an eye on our website. So there's lots more resources that will hopefully equip you and other people that you know when it comes to having these conversations with young people. So, just to round up, what can you do to be supporting us, but what can you do to be supporting young people, which is more important than us, really? Be praying, if you pray, for opportunities, for more people, because to be honest, even with the number of organizations that we've talked about already this evening or mentioned, we've reached a point where the demand in schools is higher than what we can actually meet, which is a wonderful problem to have, but we really want to be able to meet that demand and give all young people an opportunity to explore their questions. Spread the word, carry on telling schools and other people about what we do, about our resources, about the different projects that are out there. Donate. I always feel funny saying this because, you know, I'm not expecting everyone here to be millionaires, but a few of you might be. You never know. And the work that we do depends on donations, and we want to carry on doing that work. So feel free to talk to us about that as well. But also, I'm aware that it came up earlier that your £5 notes might be better spent here and on this venue. And also, Lizzie sets fire to £20 notes. So, you know, think wisely about it before you consider that. What else? Encourage your young people. So like we've been saying, we go into schools, we do things, but also you can do it as well. You don't have to be the world leading expert at something. You just have to be excited and interested about it. And so just look for those opportunities and don't assume that young people won't be able to understand what you're talking about. They're very bright, they're really interested, and once you give them some of the language that they need, then they're away and they ask those brilliant questions. Take part in some training. So we're looking to run lots of different training sessions over the years ahead to support people in communicating with young people. So watch that space. but also, yeah, I don't know. Coming here tonight is a great start, and hopefully we've helped you with some of your thinking. We're really happy to carry on answering your questions and talking about this kind of thing. So don't be afraid to run your own sessions. And this key kind of area is, the final thing is just tell your story, because young people really connect with stories. They really connect when we share about Galileo or about Darwin and some of the nuances of his understanding of science and faith. And they love story. So rather than we tend to find coming in and just saying, this is how it is, or here are the facts, you can do that. But actually, they love the human aspect of this. And in sharing your story or sharing other stories, you start to help them to think for themselves about, what's my story and what do I think about it? And what questions do I have now this person has opened up in front of me? So there's so much that can be done, and there's so many different things that you can check out. But for now, I just want to say thank you so much for listening, and I'll hand it back over to Andrew.
Well, thank you. That was really great. Great infectious enthusiasm, and I wish when I was a student I'd had someone come in and do that. Time for some questions. If you could put your hand up and wave, and Tina will bring the microphone across to you. And I see we've got one over here straight away.
That was fascinating. I only taught in secondary schools, but did you feel a great difference in the way that you had interaction with primary school students and secondary? Was there a big difference in the reaction the way you...
Yes. Essentially, very much, yes, there is quite a marked difference. Part of that is just psychologically for the young people. They've gone, often they're in a different school, they're in a different building, they feel like they're in a different stage of education, and so they act slightly differently. Part of it is just they're at an age around about 11 or 12 where a whole bunch of other stuff comes into play, and peer pressure comes into play in a different way. How they're deciding who to trust is changing, who they're relying on. You get this switch from my primary kind of source of information and my parents and maybe my teachers to suddenly I'm looking out to my peers. And a big change comes in, as Steph was saying earlier, the change in the way they're educated. So there's this shift from I learn everything from one or a couple of people in one place with the same group of peers around me, too often I'm learning very separate things in very different ways, in very different places, from different people. And that really has a huge impact. And one of the things that we see in the research is that the kind of decision, or the idea that science is over there, faith's over there, and they never come together, that happens in primary school. So it happens before you get to secondary school. So there's little things like primary students will be much more willing to give you their questions and talk to you and interact and volunteer and all of that. And around about somewhere in year 7 or 8, that kind of takes a nosedive. Picks up again in about year 11. Towards the end of year 11, everyone gets a bit more excited to volunteer again. But one of the big changes is how they're educated and how they're thinking about that. So anything that we can do to help encourage kind of intercurricular thinking is ideal. And teachers are trying hard to do that at the moment as well.
Another question over there.
That was marvellous.
Thank you.
I am a believer in evolution, and it was confirmed for me by a lady I met in Thessalonica in Greece. I spent the last 44 years in foreign missions, and she had the body and the arms and the legs of a monkey. Very, very short legs, very long arms, very solid body, and the face of a monkey, literally. And she was wearing a hoodie and a lot of covering clothes. And when she went to immigration, immigration officer couldn't see her because she was so short. And so he looked round his desk thing, and when he saw her face, he expressed shock. He'd never seen anybody like that before. It was written all over him. And he stamped her passport very quickly and sent her straight through. And so I believe that in evolution, and I believe today there are throwbacks, people who've not evolved. Interesting, isn't it?
There is a huge amount to explore that is interesting. Steph and myself both have backgrounds in evolutionary biology. As I mentioned, that's one of the topics we explore a lot. And you can see over here, maybe you may have spotted or come to see already, a few of the bits and pieces that we've brought with us that we use in schools. We do a lot of interactive work. We have an array of some of our fossils and bits and pieces here, including a few skulls, which may look slightly familiar, but perhaps not entirely familiar to you. This is a Neanderthal, and I will leave all jokes aside for now. But we take a lot of these things in so students can get hands-on and think about these and ask their questions to do with this. And the topic of evolution and whether or not we can think that it's real and put that alongside faith, but also just how it works, is something that there's a lot of misconception about and something that it's really interesting to discuss and think about. So thank you for that amazing observation.
Another question here, and then Eric. I think, Eric, did you have your hand up as well?
Yeah, one
here, and then over to Eric.
Thank you. My question's about, I help in a school in Bristol as a governor, which is a Church of England school. But surprisingly, it's heavily Muslim as a school. 98% of the kids are Muslim. It's a refugee area. Mm-hmm. Have you been into, I mean, you've talked a lot about Christian schools really tonight, but I mean, have you taken your teaching and sharing your science into other faith schools, and have you changed your message slightly or delivered it in a different way?
We work in all kinds of schools. Anybody who wants to see us, really. The majority of schools in the UK, even those that have a C of E or a Christian basis of some kind, have a very mixed attendance. We always alter what we're doing or adapt it to the school, to the particular group, to what teachers ask us for, and as we go. But we work to make sure that we're very open to questions and ideas from all kinds of different perspectives within a whole variety of religious ideas. Do you want to say some more?
Yeah, so we are generally very, very clear about our own particular faith and happy to share on that, but we are absolutely not about undermining anyone's faith. And so one of the reasons that we start often by asking a series of statements and getting in people to say whether they agree or disagree means that we get to see the range of views in the room, and that allows us to be really, really sensitive to the views of other people out there. But generally, actually, I find if I'm working with people, particularly who've been brought up in one of the Abrahamic faiths, they're just really excited as well to find someone of faith sharing about their faith and also about their enthusiasm for science. And there will be slightly different nuances in their views or what issues they might have with science being compatible with faith. But the bottom line is they're so excited to see someone who is combining those two things in some way.
Eric, I think there, and then we'll have one over here. Oh, another one there.
James, just a very brief question. The Faraday Institute produced a very excellent pack about science in school, about faith in schools, a little while ago. I think it's called Test of Faith or something, which had interviews with scientists and all sorts of things, and you haven't mentioned them at all. Where does it stand in relation to the work you're doing? I mean, you're not doing this from scratch. What happened to that? And do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so how does that fit with what you're doing?
That's a great question. The Test of Faith materials are still around. You can find them on the Faraday website. They come highly recommended. I'm sorry we haven't mentioned them. There's another thing you can use. The kind of core of the Test of Faith materials is a series of films, 30-minute films looking at all kinds of different introductory topics in science and faith. They were developed initially for use in a kind of small group setting with adults in churches or elsewhere. And there are some accessory materials for use in schools that go with that. We don't tend to use them ourselves because they're set up for teachers and others to use them. They're more a classroom resource for people where they don't have somebody to come in and kind of do it themselves. But we do recommend them. It's definitely worth picking them up. They were put together a few years ago now. They're about 10 years old. So the kind of curriculum links and stuff are not as up to date as they were. But in the main, they're very good, and they're definitely worth taking a look at. So, yes.
And they were produced by the very first development officer of Christians in Science.
Oh, this is true. There are a lot of very, very strong links. Ruth Bansovich, who produced those materials and was the very first Christians in Science development officer.
Pete Moore, who's a Bristol
is still working.
Bear, keep it there, and then we'll come over here. Sorry. Oh no! Can we just have that one, because that was close to the, and then we'll bring the mic over to you.
Do you have an opinion on the applicability of what you're doing to the parents and the parental generation of the children you've spoken to?
Many. a lot of our work is designed to help everybody who the children are relating with to think about it. So often we don't get a chance to meet the parents. Sometimes we do. Schools will arrange for a parent session afterwards. Our hope is that students, when they go home, will be talking with their parents and asking questions, and that parents will also want to support them in exploring these questions. And a lot of the work with the resources, the website and things, are part of our kind of work to try and include the rest of the family and other people in this as well, so that when we talk to the young people, that can then be backed up and followed up at home, in school, in church, wherever they may go.
So, for example, in the back of some of these books that are, in particular, the ones for 3 to 5-year-olds, we made sure to put in a little section for the adults that will get to that point who are curious, just to share a little bit more about who we are and what we do and why we do it, and links to our website, which will hopefully, if they are curious and if their curiosity is engaged by what we've done for their young people, will direct them to places where they might also explore.
Question here.
Yeah, I taught in a school in Africa where the majority of children, it's a Christian school, I guess came from families which believed in 7-day creation. How would you handle that sort of situation?
It's a wonderful topic to explore. It's really, really exciting. We, as I say, we're often in schools where there are a wide range of views, and we're aware that parents and people will have a wide range of views, so we don't go in, we're not an evangelistic organisation, we don't go in with a particular faith message that is, you must think this, and the same goes with our science. What we do is we explore what kind of majority views are out there, what different people or individuals or ourselves, what our own kind of thinking is. And we will often explore ideas about Genesis in particular and how we interpret what the Bible says about creation. And when we do that, the first thing we say is that Christians amongst them will have very different ideas about this, and that is fine. That the main thing about being a Christian is not how old you think the earth is, or how you think that God created everything. When Jesus was asked, what's the most important thing? He didn't say, the most important thing is that you all know exactly how old the universe is and how God made it. And so it's okay for us to have different ideas. We do a lot of work to do with genuinely respecting other people and their views, and to disagree well is what we really try and help people to do, to explore, to discuss, to think through where my ideas come from, where your ideas come from, and how we can have a good conversation about that. And once all that groundwork is laid, then you can start to think through, okay, well, what does the Bible say about creation? What different ways are there about thinking about it? And we will tend to unpack the view that we hold, that most of the Faraday Institute and others would hold, which is that Genesis isn't necessarily trying to teach us science, or isn't necessarily giving us a historical account, and that when the Bible is talking about creation, it's unpacking something of the purpose and the meaning of who God is and God's relationship with creation. And we do that by exploring lots of different places in the Bible where it talks about creation and God as creator and what the kind of overarching story is. And with Genesis in particular, things like the poetry of it, the relation to other creation stories of the time, how it was written. We do a lot of thinking about looking at the Bible as a source, like they would in history or English. So who wrote it? When did they write it? Why did they write it? What's it trying to communicate? All that kind of stuff. So we do a lot of thinking about that. And actually, they respond really well. And it's by the time you get to that point, you've laid all that groundwork, it's not coming as a challenge to views or beliefs. It's just kind of a, let's have a think about something you might not have thought about before. And we do the same in churches and with teachers and church workers and influencers of children in any way, really.
I think one of the biggest problems that many of us in science face is that some people who are taking that 6-day creation view refer to authoritative books that are not written by mainstream scientists, and they believe them. And one of the things we have to do is to gain trust as real scientists and Christians, to help them see, actually, maybe you want to look at some of those books. Is the science good? Because I really worry sometimes what people come up with. It's frightening. We must finish because it's 9 o'clock, and I'm sure Steph and Liz, you'll be around for a little while to answer any personal questions and stuff to look over there. There's our own CIS resources at the back there. Do take a look at those if you haven't already. But thank you both very much indeed. It was a very stimulating and enjoyable evening, so thank you.